Okay, let's start. Good morning. In the middle of the holidays. Right. Okay, good morning. I don't seem to have any amplification or any kind of microphone here. Don't know, but I'm sure you can hear me. As I said, I'm going to record this with this contraption here, and the main problem in this context is if you're asking questions, it would actually be good if the questions were on the recording as well. What I'm going to do is, if anyone says anything, I'm just going to turn this around, and then you just need to shout, okay? Well, not shout, but make sure that you say things loud enough so that your fellow students who can't be here can hear what you say, okay? Can we agree on that? Good, okay. Now, you should all have received an email about the practical bits regarding the exam. I'm not going to repeat any of this here. If you have specific questions about that, you can ask them as well, of course, but this is more about content. I thought it might be a good idea for you to have an opportunity to ask questions about things that are not entirely clear. I asked one or two people, no, I asked everyone to submit questions by email if they wanted to in preparation. Ah, I can see something has happened here. Yes, okay. And a few people have done this, so what I suggest is that I just go through these questions that I have received now, and then when there are, it's okay, wir machen das irgendwie, wir schaffen das irgendwie. Ich drehe das Ding um und dann geht das. Ja, danke. Okay, I'll go through those questions, and then after we went through those questions, the floor is open, you can ask other questions, etc. Is that fine? Okay, the first email I got. These kind of revision sessions, by the way, are dangerous. Okay, some questions I can prepare for, but others, I mean, I have no idea what questions you're going to ask, and whether I'm then always going to give the ideal response, we'll have to see. My intention is not to get you more confused than you are, so you have to bear with me a little bit. I'll try. Okay, having worked on the second assignment, I've had problems to figure out the solution to the following statement. A subordinate clause must contain a finite verb. Okay, and the question I think that I asked there is that true or false? Yeah? It is certainly clear to me that each clause, no matter if main or subordinate clause, must contain a verb phrase, and therefore a verb. But does it have to be tensed, or does it have to carry tense? Yeah? To me, it is hard to imagine a subordinate clause with an infinitive verb. Maybe the ones including the to infinitive or ing form, but in the end, I'm not quite sure. It would be nice if you could give an example of this. Okay? Yes, so, just a brief recap on this idea of tense and finiteness, etc. Okay. Just briefly, remember that English has only two tenses. It has two tenses not because it can't talk about the future, but because the future is expressed differently in the sense that there is no morphological marking that says, I'm future. Okay. So, if you see a verb and there is an ed ending, like walk and walked, okay, then the ed, morphologically speaking, or in terms of morphology, means past tense. Yeah? In this case, I walked to work today. Yeah? So, we can look at the verb form and we know whether it's past tense or not. There is no morphological unit, there is no morpheme in English where you can look at just the verb and say, this is future. There is in other languages, but not in English. So the idea is that tense is something that is morphologically marked on the verb, and anything that is expressed differently, like I will go or I should go, and all those kind of things that are expressed with modals, for example, are not part of the tense system of English. Okay? Is that clear so far? Good. Now, some verbs where we have these kind of morphological markings can be seen to give you information about tense, can be seen to carry tense. Carry in the sense that they have this morpheme and it's actually physically there. Okay. There is a problem in that, of course, we don't have that many morphological markings of tense in English because quite a few have left or have disappeared, etc. But so in the present tense, we really only have the third person singular. Okay. But the idea is that present tense and past tense are still morphologically marked. Okay, that was probably a bit confusing. But anyway, right. Where did I want to go with this? Yes, okay. There are verbs which have morphological marking, but they are not marked for tense. For example, let's look at the verb singing. Singing in the rain, for example. Singing in the rain, he felt rather wet, okay? Or stupid, or whatever, I don't know. Can you look at the verb singing and say whether this happened in the past, in the present, right now, or in the future? And the answer is no, you can't. You always need... You always need another verb that you can see this in relation to in order to make sense of whether it was before or after or at the same time with respect to the present moment. Yeah? So, singing in the rain, he felt stupid, happened in the past, but it happened in the past because of the verb felt, and not because of the form of the verb singing. I can say, singing in the rain next week, I will be feeling wet. I have changed absolutely nothing in the verb form, but now suddenly the singing happens in the future. But not because of the verb singing, but because I changed something in the main clause. Yeah? I can even say singing in the rain right now, and then whatever I feel like. Okay. So in other words, there is no information about tense whatsoever in the form singing. This is a verb which does not carry tense. It is a non-finite verb. Felt, or walked, or whatever, here in the main clause. In this case, does carry tense, and it's past tense. What kind of thing is singing in the rain? It's a subordinate clause. It's a subordinate clause because it has a main verb in it, singing. But the verb does not say anything about tense, therefore, it is a non-finite clause. Okay. To sing in the rain is great. Yeah. We have a two infinitive clause. Again, to sing in the rain does not say when it happens. We need the subordinate clause to be attached to a main clause in order to make sense about the relationship, whether it happened before, after, or something like that. Yeah? So, this is a non-finite ing clause. Okay? Ing participle clause, some people call it. It is, therefore, a subordinate clause that does not carry tense. So, let's get back to the question. A subordinate clause must contain a finite verb. Well, it is a subordinate clause It doesn't contain a finite verb. It's good English. There's nothing wrong with it. So the claim is false. Subordinate clauses can, of course, contain finite verbs. I felt silly when I found out that, or whatever. Okay, and then the when I found out is a subordinate clause, and found is in the past tense. Yeah, so there's nothing wrong with having a tensed verb in the subordinate clause, but it is possible to have non-finite verbs in subordinate clause. All right? Okay, now you need to shout. No, it's not. Why not? It's not. Good point. Why is it not? I think this is going to be really bad on the recording if I keep moving this, but yes, why is it not?
Doesn't work in this case of participle.
Yes, yes. The problem is that the inflectional system of English is quite limited. We only have a handful, a bit more than that, of inflectional endings, and some of them look the same. Now, this is not an ed past tense morpheme, but it is a participle. He has worked. Then the worked is not past tense. Let's look at a different, let's look at an irregular verb. Let's say see. He saw, yeah? He has seen. Having seen the question in the second assignment, then you can see it's not past tense. Yeah? And the having is also not tense. Yeah? So, as a general rule, always the first element in a verb group carries tense. So, if you have something like might have been being interviewed, the interviewed is not past tense, but again, participle. And the might, the modal verb might, carries tense. Okay? Other questions about this? I'm just going to leave this there, so I think it can catch me, but it might catch you as well if you speak loud enough. Shall we move on? The morphological elements of childishly and friendship. When you get a question like this, where you have to give information about the morphological structure of a word, then you ideally have to find out all the individual ones, obviously. So you look at how far you can reduce it to a root or a stem or whatever you want to call it. So with childishly, I think we can agree on the fact that the root is child. Now, you need to also say that there is such a root as child. If you don't mention the root, then you don't give a full definition, a full description of the morphological structure. So make sure, if there is a question like this, that you do not just mention the suffixes, but mention the root as well. So it's got a, this is a lexical morpheme, child. And then we have affixes, and in this case suffixes, attached to it. Child, childish. And the ish is what? Is it an inflectional or derivational? It's a derivational morpheme. Yeah? It's a derivational morpheme. Remember the definition of derivational morpheme? Remember that I talked about it in said the definition in Finnegan is not ideal. In Finnegan, a lot of emphasis is placed on the fact that it changes the word class. Okay. Child, childish. Yeah, child is a noun. Childish is not a noun. It's an adjective. Okay. But that's not the main point. That can happen. But it doesn't have to happen. More importantly, what happens is that a new lexeme or lemma, or whatever you want to call it, a new dictionary entry is formed. If you look at child and children, okay, this is a special word, it's got a special plural, then both child and children will be under the same dictionary entry. But child and childish will be different dictionary entries. So a derivational morpheme is a morpheme that creates a new lemma, or a new lexeme, I think is what I said or called it, out of a word. Yeah. And it is derivational. Yeah, that, wait, just gave a different, yeah, all right. Cool. It's the middle of the holiday. I'm not in lecturing mode. And then the ly. What do we do with that one? There's actually some disagreement about that. Hmm? What would you do with the ly? Yeah.
You say again, it's derivation.
Okay.
Because it changes the lexical category from adjective to an adverb.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah. There are some people disagree with that, but I think that's the best answer. Yes, okay. By the way, I intend to give you questions in exams where people don't disagree about. So if you feel that you are unsure about something, okay, or if you think it could be interpreted both ways, say so. It depends on the way you argue. I would go for this because, but one can also say, now there isn't actually that much space on the, so that's why I tend not to ask questions like this, okay? Yes, okay. So, the li is also derivational. Okay. Now, friendship is a bit, yeah?
I guess it's free lexical because you can't divide friendship because it doesn't mean a friendship.
Yeah, okay. A lot of people responded to this question and said this is a compound. Yeah? This was actually the exam question before, but I'd say at least 80% did. Yeah? And that's because ship looks like the thing which is on water, etc. It isn't. Okay. What is it? You said it's just one morpheme that can no longer be separated, but it's a derivational morpheme. The ship. Yeah. Okay. And friend would again be a free lexical one. How can you prove this? Well, you can think about if it is a if there is a hypothesis that ship is a derivational morpheme, then it would have to be attachable to other roots. You can have friendship, you can have relationship, you can have
membership.
Hmm?
Membership.
Membership, scholarship, and lots of ships. Yeah? They all have nothing to do with the thing that's actually sailing across the sea. And if you can come up with something like this where the same entity can be attached to roots and they seem to behave in the same way, then this is an extremely good indication that we're talking about a derivational morpheme. So this was a bit of a nasty question because it basically meant that I asked people to fall into the trap of seeing or looking at ship as, well, this is the boat that goes across the ocean. Yes?
How would you describe the morphological elements of irregular verbs, for example,
count? Well, let's just keep it easy. I won't ask you that in the question. In the exam. There are ways of dealing with this, and you're absolutely right. And there, this is when you're more interested in morphology than you can look at this. There are different ways of dealing with this, and I don't want to complicate matters. I left them out on purpose. Yes. Okay, transparent. Okay, what is the morphological structure of transparent? That is a good question. Let's go and do the same thing as I've just said you should do. What is the status of trans? Can you attach it to other elements? Yes, transnational, translucent, whatever. Okay. Yes, but that would leave parent, and the transparent. I mean, the meaning of transparent has nothing to do with parent, as in father or mother of a child. So, in fact, I would say that the best answer to this is one single morphological unit. You can always go back into the etymology, into the history of words, and then suddenly words like this, of course, go back, or they can be explained as being more than one, as containing more than one element. But I would suggest to look at how it is in present-day English. Okay? So I would say one single morphological unit. Yes?
I have another question concerning...
You need to shout.
You gave us the example of the left-handed waiter.
Yeah. Yes, this is, I mean, adjectives, I think I also said this in the lecture at some stage. Many categories of English, or in the English language, or many categories in language, are not quite as clear-cut as teachers like to tell you. Yeah? For example, what is a washing machine? What is washing? What word class is this? It's a machine that washes, yes, but it's also a machine for washing. So the word class status of washing isn't entirely clear. There are many of these words which have some features of one word class, in this case, adjective, and some features of, in this case, a verb in the participle function. And sometimes it's actually difficult to decide which is which. So if you tell me this is an adjective, then I would accept that too. But let's not complicate matters too much. Yeah? Good. Okay. Yes?
What about if you have an S in the end of the word friendship? Do you have to separate ship and ships again?
Yes, okay. Let's say we have friendship, friendships, and I ask you for the morphological structure. Then you tell me that friend is the free lexical morpheme, ship is the derivational morpheme, and the S is the inflectional morpheme, which means plural. All right? Good. Next question? No, there's another question there.
Regarding morphology, in the lecture you said there was an example sentence in which the words proposal and waiter occurred. And I wanted to know if the AL in proposal I change a noun into a verb into a noun.
I need to think about that, because, I mean, your argument would be both of them perform the same kind of conversion, right? We have a verb, propose, proposal. We have a verb to wait, waiter. But the question one would have to ask then, and I'm not sure whether we're going to answer it here, whether L and ER mean the same thing. Remember, morphology has something to do with units of meaning. So the S in friendships means third person, means plurals. means plural. Yeah? But does the AL and does the ER mean exactly the same thing? If yes, I would agree with your interpretation that it's an allomorph. If not, then they are two different morphemes. And I would have to think about whether they mean exactly the same thing. I don't know offhand. Propose, proposal, referral. The problem, of course, is that a waiter is not someone that waits. You know, that makes it even more difficult. A singer is a sing. Okay, let's do it with sing.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, proposal. We have sing, and someone who sings is a singer. We have propose, and someone who proposes is a proposal.
Yeah,
no,
okay.
Is a proposer.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So I would think that this is a very good indication for the fact that the L does not mean the same thing. And then it would therefore not be an L. You are right in describing that both change the word class from a verb to a noun, but that is not sufficient to call it an allomorph, because it's got to do with meaning.
Okay.
Yeah?
Mm-hmm.
A good question, yes.
But it's both derivational?
Sorry? Both are derivational, yes. Okay, am I managing to confuse you more than to help you, or is it still? Okay, shall we go to the next question? Okay, next question. Indicate the function of the italicized element in the following sentence. Flying non-stop from London to Sydney was considered impossible 30 years ago. What is the function? I mean, remember the difference between form and function. This is a really, really important difference. Okay? Function is things like subject, object, and adjunct. And form is things like noun phrase, verb phrase, preposition phrase, etc. So function, and remember, there is no direct relationship between form and function. Many noun phrases are subjects, but there are also many, many noun phrases that are not subjects. Many subjects are noun phrases, but there are many other ways of doing a subject, of coming up with a subject. Yeah. Right, so what's the function of flying non-stop from London to Sydney? Yeah? Subject, yes.
Why is that a subject?
Well, why is it a subject? Mm. Well, you can... Yeah, it was considered impossible, this was considered impossible. Mm-hmm.
And it stands in front of the sentence,
Yeah, these positional definitions are problematic sometimes. You're right that there is a certain fixed word order. But for example, if I say 20 years ago, flying non-stop from London to Sydney was considered impossible, then it's no longer at the beginning of the sentence. Then 20 years ago or 30 years ago is at the beginning of the sentence. You can't just say that whatever is at the beginning of a sentence is the subject. Yeah? That's probably not what you meant, but it's an additional help, but it's not the only one. Okay, yeah?
And you can ask for what or who was considered.
Yeah, okay. It is also, well, there is the subject, flying non-stop from London to Sydney, and then we've got the verb, was, to be, okay, a copular verb. That's sort of, I am happy. Okay? I is the subject, am is the predicator, am happy is the verb phrase and the predicate. All right? So, flying non-stop from London to Sydney is subject. Yes?
If we had to determine whether it's, if it would be, what kind of form it is, would flying non-stop from London to Sydney would be a noun phrase or a verb phrase?
Well, what is flying non-stop from London to Sydney? Again, this is not the easiest question, but let's see what you can come up with. What would you say? You said noun phrase, okay? What, yeah? Yes. Okay. If you say the flying from, which is odd, okay, then you have marked it very clearly as a noun. And then it would be a noun phrase. But here you could also interpret this, and this is perhaps even the more likely interpretation, as an ing participle, and therefore again as a non-finite ing participle clause. But I wouldn't ask you such a question which is where it's not clear. All right? Yeah?
What's the predicate in the sentence?
You need to speak up.
Sorry, what's the predicate in the sentence? Is it was considered or only was?
Yeah. Okay. Remember, I mean, this is the distinction that Bas Arts makes between predicate and predicator, and the predicator is actually the verb. The verb, or rather the verb group. Verb group is something that I introduced. So it's not just the was, the element that carries tense, but the was considered. So the whole verb group is the predicator. Yeah?
If you had a similar sentence and you said that there was a second subordinate clause saying, taking this example, flying non-stop from London to Sydney to have lunch with whoever was considered impossible 30 years ago.
Yes.
So you have your matrix clause, flying non-stop from London to Sydney was considered impossible. And your subordinate clause, to have lunch with the Pope. Matrix clause. I heard the whole thing and that's the correct answer, yeah? Okay, the whole thing is the matrix clause, including the subordinate clauses and everything. Yeah? Now, what, and we have how many clauses? How do you count clauses? You count numbers, the number of
lexical verbs.
Okay.
We've got was considered, okay, or the number of verb groups. Okay. We've got flying, if we follow the interpretation that this is a verb. Okay. And we have the verb have. So we have three clauses. Now, how do they relate to each other? We know already that we have one matrix clause, which is everything. What is the subject? Mm-hmm. Whoever. Yes, important. Not just flying non-stop from London to Sydney. Why? Because the to have lunch with the Pope is subordinated to flying non-stop from London to Sydney. How can you find out? Well, you could, for example, as we saw before, we can replace the subject with it or this. Yeah? Now, if you do this and you say, it to have lunch with the Pope was considered impossible, that doesn't work. But you can say, it was considered impossible, whatever, 30 years ago. What's the it? Well, flying non-stop from London to Sydney to have lunch with the Pope. Now, if you can do this, then that suggests that the next level, so to speak, okay, is, as you rightly said, flying non-stop from London to Sydney to have lunch with the Pope. It still functions as subject. It's still a clause. It's still a non-finite clause. Okay, but it now contains a subordinate clause in itself. So we have this structure where subclause 2 is embedded in subclause 1 and subclause 1 functions as subject. Make sense? And you can find out by, for example, replacing the subject with it, and then you need to replace everything. Mm-hmm.
And the noun phrase in this sentence is the same as the subject?
Which noun phrase?
Flying non-stop from London to Sydney to have lunch with the Pope. Would that be the noun phrase?
No, because we said that this was a verb.
But we weren't quite sure about it.
Yeah, but let's just agree it is a verb. Yeah? I'm not saying the flying, but I'm saying flying. Okay, I'm risking something now to confuse you a little further, but let's just look at the subordinate clause, flying non-stop from London to Sydney to have lunch with the Pope. What is the subject of that subordinate clause? Who does the flying? Yes. You work it out yourself.
The subject of the subordinate clause.
No, not quite. Flying is a verb, right? Yeah?
Us flying.
Us or whoever does the flying. Somebody flying. People flying. Remember, in subordinate clauses, you don't necessarily have to have a subject. Yeah? So this is a subordinate clause which only consists of a verb phrase, but we're really going into detail here, more detail than you need to know, I think. Well, I can't remember now. I purposely did not look at the exam before coming here. Okay. All right, does that answer your question? Yeah?
On the other hand, if you say that no subject in subordinate clauses is needed or are needed, no subjects are needed, I do have kind of a problem because we still do have the subject even though it's hidden.
Yes.
But what? Can we say it's not there?
It's not there.
Or integrated or somehow, but it's still there.
It, I mean, it's semantically, notionally, it's there because we can retrieve who does the flying. But it's not there on a syntactic level. Singing in the rain, I felt silly. Singing in the rain is again a subordinate clause without a subject. Me singing in the rain, I felt silly. I can put it there. Yeah? Or I sing, well, anyway. So in non-finite subordinate clauses, you can leave out the subject. If this is unclear, there is one of the chapters in Bas Arts which lists the different forms of subclauses, and you can look at which ones are with the subject on it on their own and which ones are without. You look worried. No, okay, good. All right?
But for me, the subject is clear. If we have singing in the rain, I felt silly, we have the I.
Yeah, but where do you have the I? You have the I in this as the subject of the matrix clause. Yeah? So if you have singing in the rain, he felt silly. Then it's really, it's not there, but it's retrievable. And it's as if it sort of doesn't need to be there because it is retrievable. Yeah. All right? What's the function of 30 years ago?
Yeah.
It's an adjunct, yeah. It's an adjunct which is additional information and which can be left out without making the sentence ungrammatical. It's not a complement, it's not something that is required by the verb, for example. Okay? Good. Third question. Produce a sentence with a noun phrase that has indefinite non-specific reference. We will be talking about these sort of reference, or maybe we could even do it now. I know I confused a lot of people by introducing reference. What is it? Meaning and sense? Or I think that's what I did, right? Yeah. Okay. Some people have asked me about sense. This is the least important of the three terms. Sense, I would say, is just basically sort of the conventional meaning as represented in the dictionary. The kind of idea you have of chair, as in something that usually has four legs and looks like this thing there. I wouldn't worry about sense. If we look at reference, then things become a bit more important. What is reference? Well, it is about whether we can find a clear referent that we refer to. Remember, words are referring expressions. And the example that I gave there in the context of definite and indefinite reference was the example of what did I give you there? Chair. Let's say with chair. Okay. We can talk about the chair, or we can talk about a chair. If it is the chair, then the reference is filled. It's there. Okay. We can point to it. If we say a chair, then it is indefinite. And then on top of that, we have specific versus non-specific. And the difference there is, if I talk about let's stick with my chair example. My example back in the lecture, I think, had to do with going to buy a chair at IKEA, right? If I'm going to buy a chair from IKEA, then I do not know which specific chair I get. I may have an idea that I want, I don't know, a particular type of chair. I want, what are these chairs called? I mean, these comfortable ones where you can... Forgot the name now. You know the model, but which of the 55 that are currently in stock at IKEA I get is not clear. It's not specific. But, I bought a chair. Look, there it is. Remember the difference between marrying a woman with blue eyes, she's called Mary, then a woman with blue eyes has a specific reference, but no, I don't know who I'm going to marry, but it has to be someone with blue eyes. I want to marry a woman with blue eyes. That's not the same as having someone specifically in mind and she has blue eyes. Yeah, this has got to do with the fact that you can refer to the same entity in different ways, and depending on context, this means the same thing, right? So Roger Federer and the best player in the world, well, at the moment probably not because he's number three,
yeah.
But anyway, yes. Now I know what you mean. Yeah, exactly, that's the point. 5 years ago, yes, okay, he was the best player. Best tennis player, and if you just said the best tennis player in the world, you would automatically be referring to Roger Federer. Nowadays, you're not doing this because someone else is considered the best player in the world. So the referring expression, the best tennis player in the world, like the prime minister or whatever, does not refer to the same person anymore. But yes, you're right, it's got to do with reference. But again, in the many of the topics that I'm discussing in the first year, in the first semester, are enormously complex. Okay? And people have written, I mean, also these things, we'll be talking about implicatures in the moment. Okay? This whole idea about speech act, implicatures, cancelability, etc., books have been written about this. I need to give you a very basic, the basics, and there's always much, much more to us. So, let's keep it simple. Yeah?
So, is there actually a difference between indefinite and nonspecific? I think I get it.
Yeah, well, if you say that I want to marry a woman with blue eyes, then that's nonspecific, possibly, and then also indefinite.
What about
but I can make it specific, but still use an indefinite form. I want to marry a woman with blue eyes, she's called Mary.
But then we need two sentences.
Yeah, but I mean, if I'm giving you the context, basically. I want to marry a woman with blue eyes, but I don't know who it is yet.
Non-specific.
In the second case, it's non-specific. In the first case, it is specific. She's called Mary.
Okay.
But in both cases, we're using an indefinite form.
What about the sentence, a woman came in with a dog?
Yeah.
It's indefinite, non-specific. How can we change that in indefinite, specific?
Wait a minute. A woman came in with a dog. Okay. A woman is indefinite, but it's a specific woman that comes in. We can see her, right?
But this was an example from your lecture, and you said this is indefinite and specific.
had blue eyes. That's clearly an example of an indefinite noun phrase that is often used to bring in new information, okay, to introduce new reference. And by doing this, it becomes referential then. Okay, then the woman, after having been introduced, becomes referential. But it is done initially with an indefinite noun phrase.
So could we say that as soon as we get more information, it becomes more specific, so it is a specific reference?
I don't like this, as soon as we get more information. I have this dream. I want to marry a woman with blue eyes. And actually, she's also got to have rather long hair, and she shouldn't be as tall as I am. I can say a lot of information about this woman, but she still remains non-specific.
Because it's a woman.
Because I haven't met her yet, and I don't know. Yeah? All right? But we can look at the slides again after. Right, so, let's... Yes?
I didn't quite get that one with the indefinite one. I mean, a specific reference is always about a concept or a specific person, I think.
Yeah, whether you can have a specific identifiable referent that is referred to, yes. A chair, I want to go and buy a chair at IKEA. There is no specific element in there, but it could be filled with any of the sort, any chair that meets my criteria.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And what's the thing with indefinite and definite?
That's about whether you use an indefinite or a definite article to refer to something. I mean, if you have a the chair, then it is a definite article, which I'm saying it now, which typically then also means it's got specific reference. But you can have, oh gosh, I told you it was dangerous. You can have, no, I don't want to, no. Does, I mean, have I answered your question already? I'm not quite yet.
Could you make an example in a sentence?
Of what?
With an indefinite one and a non-specific reference.
For example, as I've said before, I want to marry a woman with blue eyes. But I don't know yet who she is. As long as she's got blue eyes, I'm going to be happy.
So that one would be non-specific.
It's non-specific and indefinite. But if I actually have had this girlfriend with blue eyes for a long time and I finally want to marry her, I could talk to you and say, I want to marry a woman with blue eyes. In fact, here she is. Whether it makes perfect sense to do this or not is a different question, but you can do it. Mm-hmm.
Contest.
Yeah.
The girl is not, I don't know this girl, so.
Exactly, yes, thank you. That was an example that I was looking for. The girl with the most beautiful dress will win the contest. We have a definite noun phrase. But we have a non-specific reference because we have 55 girls in this room who are competing for it, but we don't know yet who is going to get it. Thank you, yes. All right. So, produce a sentence with a noun phrase that has indefinite, non-specific reference. Please underline the noun phrase. I want to marry a girl with blue eyes. A girl with blue eyes is non-specific and indefinite if I don't know her. underline the noun phrase. Please make sure you underline the noun phrase. In every single exam that I've had over the past years, there've always been a few people who don't underline. I can look at their answers and I can see that they probably mean the right thing. But if there is only a single other noun phrase in there, it's not, I mean, I can't count it. Yeah? So please make sure, I mean, maybe when you get the exam script on Monday, just put a note on the top, on the cover sheet, and say, underline, question mark. Okay? And then at the end of the exam, you go back to it, and then you make a tick when you have actually checked whether you've underlined everything. It's silly, but... All right. Produce a sentence whose subject contains a restrictive relative clause. Can someone give me that? Yeah.
That student who failed the exam last time has to resit the exam.
Okay. The student, you don't even have to point towards it. The student or students who failed the exam last time need to repeat it. So it's not all students, luckily. But it's only a subgroup, it's only a restricted group. And namely those who have not passed, who did not pass the last time. And then it says underline the subject. What's the subject? In your sentence?
The student who failed the exam.
Yes. The student or students who failed the exam, not just students. Yeah, remember. Good. We are already at email number 2. Okay. Shall we go to email number 3? Okay. We've done most of that now. I'm not going to talk more about sentence references. Okay. A lot of people seem to have some trouble with this idea of implicatures, etc., and about sort of indirect speech acts, etc. And one question that I got here is, what's the difference between a cancelable implicature and a standard implicature? Again, I could now start making things very, very complicated, and a lot of people have written about implicatures and conversational implicatures and standard implicatures and conventional implicatures and all those kind of things. Again, I don't want to complicate this too much. Let's just briefly recap what it means to be cancelable. Well, what it means for an implicature to be cancelable. Or maybe we should go back a bit further and even start with the concept of implicature. What is an implicature? Okay. An implicature is something that you need to read into rather than looking at the sort of propositional content of what you say. If I say, it's cold in here, and you are in charge of the heating, then you can see my statement as meaning, could you please change the heating so that I won't feel it cold anymore. But that inference that you draw, that implicature that you see, is not in my words, it's cold in here, but it is in what you think I must have meant. So that's an inference that you draw. Now, what does it mean to be cancelable? It means that the person who's uttered this, or who said this, can claim not to have meant it to mean this. Okay? So, let's say I say it's cold in here, you're in charge of heating, but you also have to pay for it. Okay? And you don't really want to yank up the heating because it's going to cost you 50 euros, and we're all going to be out here soon anyway. Yeah? So you say, yeah, you know, it's a bit expensive, and I'm not sure. Oh, no, I didn't mean that. I just said it was cold in here. It's actually quite nice to be cold. I mean, otherwise everyone needs, I don't know, sweating and whatever. So I can claim, even though I may have meant it, I can claim that I never said that. if I say I have two cats, then I cannot say, but I only have one. Doesn't work. Now, if I say something like, I have two cats, then of course, the standard implicature is that I only have two cats. Why would I otherwise say it? Okay? The term standard implicature is used by many people for the kind of obvious deductions that you can draw from the statements, kind of obvious, not logical, but kind of obvious and almost conventionalized, that you draw on the basis of the assumption that people are cooperative. Why should I say that I have two cats if in fact I have 13? It's true, I do have three, I do have four, but why not just say that I have 13?
If I say pass the salt, then
yep.
The standard implicature would be pass the salt now.
Yes.
And the one who's in charge of the salt, basically,
yeah.
Who's the nearest to the salt.
Yeah, yeah.
But if he refuses to give me the salt, I could cancel my implicature by saying, well, I just said pass the salt, but not to me.
With these standard implicatures, where we are basically assuming that people are cooperative, it becomes actually quite odd to cancel them. Pass the salt, but I don't mean now, or I didn't mean now, or something like that, is because they are so conventional. Yeah? So this thing with the cancelability really only meaningfully applies to what people call conversational implicatures, namely the kind of interpretations that come out of the context of a conversation. So if I say it's cold in here, then this is not standard in the sense that you can almost deduct from the meaning of the words what I want. Yeah? While with pass the salt, now, we assume that it only makes sense, it's only relevant to say it if I actually mean that you want, that you should do it now. So cancelability really refers to the kind of meaning that comes out of context, that is different every time, perhaps even. While standard implicatures are often very difficult to cancel. But what I can definitely not say is, I have two cats, but in fact I only have one. I can say I have two cats, in fact I have 13. I can do this, logically, but it would be odd.
All right.
Okay? Don't think I confused too many people this time. Yes, okay.
If I am, for example, in a restaurant, and I call the waiter and say, I'm thirsty, then it is a standard implication, isn't it? Because I would say to the waiter, I'm thirsty when I don't want to have something.
Again, I mean, some people call standard implicature really only if it's almost in the meaning of the words. So, for example, Bill is ill, so he has to rest. Almost lexically means that there is a relationship between the two. Okay? You're absolutely right. There are some contexts which are so conventionalized that it becomes standard, but let's not worry too much about the difference between standard and conversational implicatures. Yeah? The important thing is that implicatures are things that need interpretation and that are not logical relationships. So if I say Ian drives a Toyota, and Toyota only makes cars, then I cannot say Ian drives a Toyota, but he doesn't drive a car. Yeah? Because all Toyotas are cars. Yeah? So that's a logical relationship, and that's not an implicature. That's what's called an entailment. Yeah? That's the important difference. Yes?
But now I don't understand the difference between implicature and the illocutionary.
The implicature is basically the illocution reaction. It's the kind of the meaning that the force that is conveyed by uttering whatever I say. Yes, that's let's equate them. Yeah. Again, there will be much more, but let's do that. Yes. Yeah. All right. Can we move on? Ah, yes. Speech, face-threatening acts and politeness, etc. Okay. Would you agree with the following remarks? The more threatening the speech act is, the higher the possibility that one does not do the face-threatening act at all. The less threatening it is, the higher the chance for an FTA on record and without redressive action being uttered. Is that true? What do you think? Some people nod?
I mean, the more you're indirect, the more you do the face-threatening act, right?
No. Okay, the more... The more you are indirect, the more you do the face-threatening act? No, not quite yet.
The more indirect you are, the more polite you are.
Yes. Okay. The more indirect you are, the less of a threat it is, basically. Because, for example, it is cancelable. If I know that you are in charge of heating, then I know that by my request to put out the heating, I will cause you some, well, financial loss or whatever, or I might even, well, it means that you have to go up there and do it. I'm imposing on you. Now, I'm not entirely sure whether I should do this or not. Possibly because you are my boss, you are the Queen of England, you are the person... I just, for whatever reason, feel that I shouldn't be doing this. Possibly. Or that I'm afraid that you may not feel 100% happy about it. Now, if I say, could you please put out the heating, then you cannot, if I do this, then I cannot ever claim that I didn't ask you to put up the heating. That is fairly direct. I was being polite, I said please, and I didn't just say put up the heating, but there is no way I can claim that I've not done it. But if I say it's cold in here, then I give you the option of not hearing it, of just basically, it's that time of the year, it doesn't really make sense to heat anymore, etc. And then I would have made the statement, and perhaps we would both have even interpreted it in the same way, but I've given you an option not to respond to this. And I do this because I estimate the face risk, the risk of face loss to be higher than I really want to risk. If I am your boss, for example, and I am in charge and I actually pay and whatever, or even if I don't pay, I don't know, then I may feel less need to reduce the face threat. And I may feel more comfortable giving you the order to put up the heating no matter what. So I will do it in a more direct way. I will not use face work. I will not use off-record, indirect ways. But I may be polite and just say, please put up the heating. Or I may even be very direct and just say, put up the heating. All right? So the greater the estimate of face loss, the more polite, the more face work is necessary. In fact, the face loss may be estimated to be so great that I won't even do the speech act. Okay? So, let's go back to this. The more threatening the speech act is, the higher the possibility that one does not do the FTA at all. Yes, I mean threatening in the sense, the greater the loss, the greater the face loss, the less likely it is that I do it, if I mind that that there is such a threat. It depends, of course, on the kind of imposition. It depends on if I want to borrow some money from you, how much it is. It depends on our relationship and all sorts of other aspects. But yes, basically, I would be quite happy with that statement. Is it clear now?
I find it difficult to distinguish between positive and negative politeness.
Okay, what's the difference between positive and negative politeness? Remember that, according to Goffman, and that's where this idea comes from, everyone has two faces. A negative face and a positive face. The negative face refers to the wants to be left alone or to be your own boss, basically, not to be imposed on. And it being imposed on basically could mean just to ask you to switch on the heating. I mean, that's one way. I'm basically imposing on your want to be your own. Your own boss, let's call it like that, okay? Or your own person, and not be asked to do something for me. And the positive phase refers to your need to be part of a larger society, to be liked, to be wanted, to have your face wants confirmed and to be part of it. So if you, for example, want something from somebody, okay, let's go back to the heating. I heard you had a new heating system in here. I thought this was really, I mean, from what I've heard, this is really top notch. Would you mind switching it on so that I can see how it works? So in a way, I'm commending that person on something good, making him or her feel liked positively, well, be part of some group, and therefore make it easier for that person to do something.
I've got another example. For example, positive would be, Bill, my friend, I'm sure you can move your car, can't you? And negative would be, I'm sorry to ask, but could you possibly move your car a little bit?
Yes, okay. If I say I'm sorry, then I indicate to you that I'm aware that I'm imposing on your negative face. I'm showing you that I'm aware of it and that I shouldn't really be doing this, but I will do it anyway. But if I sort of say, Bill, my friends, then I'm in a way suggesting, I mean, these are black and white examples, but I'm sort of suggesting that this person is liked and that we're good buddies, etc. And that will make it easier for that person to move the car. Yeah? Yes?
But an attack on the positive face will always contain a little bit of negative faith, right? Because with the example of the heating, would you mind switching it on? It will still be, I impose on you to switch it on. Otherwise it wouldn't be a favor.
Thinking whether, I mean, you're absolutely right that it might be both. I'm just thinking of whether.
Because I didn't find any example for a purely positive face attack.
For a face attack which is reduced by purely appealing to the positive face.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Is that an example?
Is it a disagreement, simply? Maybe if you ask me if, I don't know, I like your new shirt. Really?
I like your work usually, but perhaps this is not the best that you've written so far. Yeah?
Mm-hmm.
So I'm appealing, I'm making you realize that I like you, well, I like your work, and therefore you, in the, as in the kind of academic entity that you are, or whatever, but I use this to express some factual criticism about your work. Yeah? Yeah? Okay. Gosh, we're already 1 hour and 15 minutes. Yes?
Does to not do the MTA always mean to say nothing, or can it also be to tell a lie? How can you realize
it? Well, to not do the face-threatening act basically would mean to not perform the act that you had planned to do. You may, of course, do something else in as a result, but just basically, you want to perform a speech act of, I don't know, X. And if you then decide not to do it, that's it. Yeah?
Oh, but it also can be face-threatening if you don't say anything at all.
Oh, yes, of course. Yeah, yeah. I mean, silence, as we've seen, silence can mean something. Yeah, yeah, sure. Yes. Again, that's a complication that maybe we shouldn't look at that. Yeah, but yes, you're absolutely right. And that brings us to the organization of discourse and the fact that something would actually be required, but something doesn't follow, may actually be a face threat. Yes, you're absolutely right. Yes?
So again, if we say, Bill, my friend, would you move the car, please? Bill, my friend, would somehow be a positive politeness in a way?
Would be an appeal to the positive face of that person,
right.
Yes.
And would you move your car? That's when the negative face is threatened. Because I want him to do something.
Yes. Well, basically, the whole thing as such is interpreted as the act, as the face-threatening act. But we couch it in ways that appeal to the positive face. And you're, of course, right again. I mean, that's basically trying to get some... it's both positive and negative. That's what he meant. Yes.
Mm? I think to clarify this, one could say that the positive politeness's aim is to establish a positive relationship between the parties. And regarding the negative politeness, to make a request less infringing. And this is more difficult in terms of the negative politeness because the person I may not quite know.
I didn't get the last bit.
I think it's always a question of relations, if you know the person who you talk about.
Well, that's one aspect. It's only one. You're absolutely true. It's one important aspect. What kind of relationship do you have? But it also depends on the kind of imposition. If it's something really, really big, if the request is huge, would you might... I don't know. Yeah.
I mean, it would be more challenging to make the request less infringing when you do not know your...
It depends. People have generally felt that, have looked at this. If you know someone extremely well, then it's easier to make a face threat. If you know someone not at all, it's also fairly easy to make that threat. But it's the people in between who you don't really know that well, but who you interact with, and who you will probably interact with next week too, and therefore it matters what you do, that you need to be more careful. But if I meet someone, I don't know, in Tokyo at the airport, and I'm pretty sure that I'm never going to meet her again, what does it matter? Alright? So... Can we move on to the next slide? That's the last one that I have here. quite 100% understand that question, but let's see whether we can work it out. Is it? It is possible to say that flowers and trees are hyponyms of the hyperlim plant. Yes. Okay. Plant is the superordinate term, and both of them are hyponyms. Roses, tulips, and daffodils are in turn hyponyms, or co-hyponyms, of the hyperlim flower. Could you kind of bring them together, e.g. W, X, and Y are hyponyms of the hyperlim Z? Or is it always the case that X is the hyponym of Y, and Y is the hyponym of the hyponym Z, and so on? I'm not entirely sure what it means. If the person wants to own up and say, it was me, can you explain what you meant? Or can we do it together? Or otherwise, I'll just say something about hyponymy.
Yeah.
Okay, go ahead.
And the thing is, do you just compare hyponyms and hyponyms, or could you say this is the hyponym, this is hyponym 1, hyponym 2, something like that? Do you have to? Is it always so that you have one hyponym and one hyponym, or is it? Are there any other possibilities?
I mean, basically, it's a bit like a syntax tree. Yeah? So you have a node, yeah. Now, all of the ones down here are co-hyponyms of the hyponym C. They are also hyponyms of this, but there is sort of one category in between. Yeah. Yeah. That was all. Okay. All right. So, what else do you need to know? Okay. Yeah, it's a bit like the example that I gave you of the interchange in the shop that the person wanted to buy some color, etc. And I mean, there is a question at the beginning that in the end actually doesn't get answered, but it's always still there in the room. And we have sort of several insertion sequences, one could say. I would say that they're different insertion sequences because you can look at each of them as a separate unit. Yeah? Because each of them, again, was a question and a response. And you could, in a way, remove one of them and you would still have an insertion sequence left. Yeah? But that's a minor thing, I would say. Okay, next question.
I have a question concerning speech acts again.
Yeah?
If you have the sentence, would you pass the salt, please? Do we have to say, when we describe the sentence, is it a request or is it a directive? Which one do you want to hear in this case?
Okay, let's make it easy. Let's keep it easy. I do not want you to name specific speech acts. Yeah? I know there are lists of speech acts, and some include 17 different speech acts. Some include only 10, and then some are missing, etc. The important thing is for you to realize it is a speech act. But I am not really interested either in a list of speech acts, nor a specific description of this is definitely a directive or something. Partly because these categories are not very well defined. Yeah. It's the principle rather than the actual naming. And in fact, it probably in this case depends on context as well what it is. Okay? Yes?
Are the verb phrases in "she never writes home," writes home, and in "this book saddens me"?
She never writes home. Okay, what's the verb phrase here? Subject, and never writes home in this case is the verb phrase, the predicate, and never is part of the verb phrase because what does it do? It tells you something about how the writing happens. It gives you additional information about the writing. It doesn't give you additional information about she or her or whatever. So it would belong in a syntax tree, it would belong to the verb phrase. Where exactly you would put it there, let's not worry about. But it would belong there.
And the other sentence, "this book saddens me"?
Yeah?
The verb phrase would be "saddens me."
Saddens me, yes. "This book saddens me." Saddens me is the verb phrase.
Okay.
Yeah?
Because to write is in this case a transitive verb, or why? Because it means
sorry, can you...
In this case, we need home to be part of a verb phrase because write is in this case a transitive verb, so it needs an object, so never writes.
Okay, the easy answer. We have a general difference between, or the major distinction in a sentence between subject and predicate. Anything that's not in the subject is in the predicate, and therefore in the verb phrase. Okay. Now you are absolutely right in the sense that write typically is a transitive verb. She writes letters, she writes books, she writes emails and whatever. And home does not have exactly the same status as this because it's not what you write but where you write to. Okay. But in the interest of not confusing people, I would rather not discuss this any further.
Right.
Yeah. It has to do with the fact that some people claim that adjuncts can be can be obligatory. But yes. Okay. What is it that makes it complex? I mean, it's basically, it's a different lecture from the others because it talks about a methodology. You can do syntax with corpus linguistics, you can do morphology with corpus linguistics, you can do pragmatics with corpus linguistics. A bit more difficult because it's, yeah, but it's possible. Okay. What makes it complex? Basically, as I said, a method, and it's a way of finding answers to linguistic questions, obviously. And the lecture is about a number of concepts that need to be known about or need to be considered when you want to do this in a sensible way. So, for example, that's why I talked about representativeness. The whole idea of the corpus is that you take a relatively small set of language, which is authentic, but which is not the whole, and you look at this and then try to draw conclusions about the rest of the language on the basis of that. Now, if you want to do this, you need to think about the status of this little bit of language that you have, and how representative it is of everything else. And as long as you know how representative it is, or as long as you have an idea of how the two things relate to each other, how well this little corpus sort of reflects what's happening, then you can evaluate your findings. So representativeness is one important aspect. I also talked about the fact that corpus linguistics gives you access to not only your own intuition, but to how people use it that are very, very different from you. You're not a lawyer, you're not... you are who you are, you're not where you're not. You know? But you now have, if you use a corpus, access to the language production of a wide variety of people. In fact, you don't even have to be a native speaker to do this. So, and I talked about representativeness. I also talked about things like normalization or relative frequencies, because it's important, because it allows you to compare things. A lot of people make mistakes, basic mistakes, doing this kind of thing. That's why I introduced these concepts. But I think the main thing to take away is that this is one way of doing linguistics, and it is good for certain questions. It's not good for other questions. And there are certain practical things that you need to consider in order to do it right. That's basically all there is. Yes?
And we talked about recall and precision.
Yes.
What is better, to have a full recall or a precision?
Yes, okay. I talked about recall and precision. Remember, or I'll give you, I'll recap what they are. Precision refers to the facts, or to the situation where you look at, let's say, 50 instances that you retrieve from a corpus, trying to answer a question. Now, if all of the ones that you look at, if all of the 50 are actually relevant for answering the question, are what you wanted to retrieve, then your precision is 100%. If you're in, let's say you're retrieving noun phrases, you want to know something about the structure of noun phrases, and you retrieve 50 things, and all of these are noun phrases, then they're relevant. But if, then precision is 100%, sorry. But if, let's say, you have retrieved 50 things, but only 30 of those actually are noun phrases, then precision is no longer 100%, but then it's 60%, because it's 60 of 100 or 30 or 50 instances that are actually relevant. Obviously, you want all of your instances to be relevant, because it reduces work. I mean, if not everything is relevant, then you need to first sort things out. Then you need to manually go through and say, nah, this is not a noun phrase, not a noun phrase, not a noun phrase. Ah, here's one. Okay. Now, ideally, if you all get noun phrases at the beginning, everything, fine. The problem is, are these all noun phrases in the corpus? Did we retrieve everything that we wanted? If not, then recall is not 100%. Let's say I want to retrieve all instances of subordinating clauses with ing, and I only find data. I only found 20, but in fact there are 30 in there. Then recall is not 100%. Then recall is, well, 20 out of 30. Now, which is better, recall or precision? If you are interested in giving an exhaustive description, if you want to write about ing clauses or noun phrases, if you are not just looking for nice examples, then the answer is recall. Because if you have everything that's relevant, but it also contains stuff that's irrelevant, then you can easily throw away the irrelevant stuff. Yeah? It means manual work, but you can do this. But if you start with something that doesn't contain everything, well, then you don't have everything. And then what you say, what you describe, may not be actually about everything that's relevant. You may have missed something very important. Yeah? So, and in corpus linguistics, we try to optimize both precision, because that means less work, and recall. And in an ideal world, we would have 100% precision, 100% recall. That doesn't usually work. But if then in doubt, you try to reduce precision rather than recall. Yes, up there.
Could you please explain what the difference
between homonymy and polysemy? Homonymy and polysemy. I think I actually misspelled that word again, but don't worry about it. Homonymy and polysemy. Okay. Right, let's quickly do this again. I'm not sure whether someone's going to be here at 12 o'clock, so if people start moving in, then we'll have to stop. And I think the recording machine also stops in a few minutes. Homonymy and polysemy. Both refer to elements that look and sound the same. But in the case of homonymy, that's all there is to it. It's just two words that look and sound the same. They have absolutely no connection whatsoever. How do you know? You know by looking it up in the dictionary and looking at their history. Okay, or yeah. But basically they have nothing to do with each other. Okay, maybe that's a way of throwing us out. With polysemy, we have two words that are conceptually related, that have something to do with each other, that maybe have a common source. One maybe has developed out of the other via metaphorical extension. The favorite example I have in this context, and maybe I'll just repeat this because it's a good example that shows both